Welcome back to Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis.
I'm Lita. Ron will not be with us today.
And I'm Jean Marie. Collectively, we are the hosts of Podcast DX.
Today's episode focuses on a complex and often misunderstood condition, POTS, or Postural Orthostatic Tachycardia Syndrome. It's a form of dysautonomia that affects blood flow, causing a range of debilitating symptoms when a person moves from lying down to standing.
To help us explore this topic, we are honored to welcome a true pioneer of the field, or in the field, Dr. Diana Driscoll. She is an optometrist, researcher, author, and CEO of Genetic Disease Investigators. Dr. Driscoll is best known for releasing the Driscoll theory back in 2012, which shifted how patients with POTS and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome were evaluated and treated.
And that book was a game changer.
Yes.
That's when I first learned about Dr. Driscoll. It identified a key physiological factor that had been overlooked, like abnormal intracranial pressure, vagus nerve dysfunction, and vascular instability, all contributing to the symptoms of POTS.
And Dr. Driscoll, we want to welcome you to the show and thank you ever so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to join us today.
I am so honored to be here. Really, I appreciate your work so much to help us get in touch with other people who are suffering needlessly, honestly. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And for those that are unfamiliar, could you please explain what POTS is and how it typically presents?
Yes, and POTS is extraordinarily complex, but it stands for Postural Orthostatic Tachycardia Syndrome. And that means basically when the patient stands up, their heart starts to race. It's considered to be a disorder of the autonomic nervous system, the part of the nervous system that controls parts of the body, and we shouldn't have to think about it, like digestion, heart rate, blood pressure. And when that's broken, things start falling apart. But the label of POTS is really limiting. I think most practitioners see that and they think, oh, this is a heart problem because the heart is going fast. And certainly when I was a patient, the doctors wanted to just slow down the heart. And I was sick from head to toe. I was completely disabled by this. And I said, it's so much bigger than that. I said, could you ignore the heart rate and then look to see what happened to the rest of me? And maybe we could figure out why the heart is going so fast. Mm-hmm. But at that time, nobody was doing that, which was a real puzzle to me. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. I could understand that.
Yes.
And many people don't realize, yeah, that it is, it's far-reaching and the symptoms are kind of extensive. And can you elaborate on what patients actually experience day-to-day and what your experience has been?
Right.
Yes, absolutely. Because thinking of POTS, of course, the heart rate goes up or it varies. It's very labile. It's fragile to some degree. It'll swing wildly sometimes. And blood pressure, like what you described, Jean, sometimes can go down, sometimes can go up, sometimes can stay the same. But the head-to-toe problem that patients deal with is that, gosh, I suffered with neck tightness, certainly the dizziness, fairly chronic nausea. I was weak and shaky. My balance was poor. My digestion basically shut down. I went from horrible constipation with episodic diarrhea, which I was so excited to have diarrhea because at least it would relieve the constipation, to ultimately gastroparesis, where just nothing was moving. My gallbladder stopped working. And then the symptoms tended to just change and morph over time. They never seemed to be stationary. And I had a list of symptoms that I would take to doctors. And before I would go to the doctor, I'd pull it up and adjust it and change it. And it's like we're chasing this moving target. Mm-hmm. But at my worst, organs were starting to suffer. I was in chronic kidney disease for stage 3 for 3 years.
Oh,
I was developing congestive heart failure. I had to sleep sitting up because my lungs would fill with fluid. I was bedridden for many years. And then horrifyingly, my son got sick about a year and a half later from just regular viruses, and he was disabled. He developed severe osteoporosis. He broke his arm just throwing a ball, just putting on his coat, and he couldn't go to school. And I felt like, why is nobody jumping up and down that this is an emergency, you know, this is horrible? And instead, they told us that this huge cluster of symptoms just meant that we were more aware of our own bodies, that everything was fine, and it was basically all in our head. Thought, well, that's nuts, you know. So that's when I set up genetic disease investigators and thought, we're on our own. Let's start digging into this and see what kind of answers we can find. So the presentation for patients is extraordinarily varied, and to some degree it depends how long they've been sick, and not everybody is the same, but a lot of us become basically disabled. We cannot continue a normal life.
Right.
It sounds like it can really disrupt your life, because it's everything. It's your you know, it's your gastrointestinal, you know, it's gastrointestinal issues, it's neurological symptoms, it's cardiovascular symptoms. You're tired, your temperature is out of whack, you can't control your own temperature. It's hard to exercise. When we think of exercise, we think about like going out and actually, you know, seeking out exercise, but day-to-day tasks are challenging. Yeah, and even sleep is affected.
Yes, no, good point. For the first three and a half years of my illness, I had horrible insomnia with the night sweats, etc. But then things started to change where I developed extreme fatigue, mental and physical fatigue, and then I couldn't stay awake. So it went to where I was asleep all but maybe an hour and a half in the morning, an hour and a half at night, and it was getting worse. And I asked my neurologist, what happens? Do we just eventually just snuff out, you know, stop waking up? What the heck? And he said it sounded neurodegenerative, but he couldn't seem to nail a diagnosis. But the effects on the brain and the systemic health were significant. And to not be validated by the doctor, or say you just need to push through, you can learn to live with this or whatever, just seemed outrageous to me. And stubborn me, I just refused to accept that for my kids. Both of my kids ended up sick, that we were going to, they were going to miss an entire life. So set to work trying to get answers for that.
So how old were your children when they developed it?
Yes, my son got sick when he was 8 years old. And my daughter started to show symptoms around the age of 12. And my son, we could kind of point to what happened. These three viruses he got, just regular viruses, each one knocked him down further. And then that third one, that was it. My daughter, we never found like a trigger for her. But at the age of 12, she was starting to lose the ability to stand up comfortably, like what you said, Jean. She would start flushing, you know, get sweaty, her heart rate would pick up, and then she'd feel like she was going to faint. So she was able to stay in school. But my son was not, and I was disabled by it too. So, yeah.
Very hard.
It can be really hard for someone to get a diagnosis because you're having, you know, a wide range of symptoms that cover a wide range of
So who do you
functions.
Go to? Do you go to a gastroenterologist?
Do you go to, the cardiologist, go to a neurologist? And are they all giving you different medications, different diagnoses?
Right.
And that's a real challenge.
But then Dr. Driscoll walks in.
You're great. Yeah, I knew I didn't suddenly have like 80 different diseases, you know. I went to every specialist known to man. I went to probably 50 doctors. I'm not exaggerating. Wow. I thought, I'm not getting to the right doctor. It's not subtle. They're missing something, and I need to find the right doctor to diagnose it. And when I got the diagnosis of POTS, I celebrated that at first, thinking, oh, we understand what's going on. There's going to be a treatment plan, a prognosis. No, that was basically a dead end. They said, we don't know what causes this. We're going to just basically try to cover up the symptoms. And that was just horrifying to hear. So you're right. It's difficult to get a diagnosis. And then once you get the diagnosis, you're not really getting any help with it. So situation to be in. So yeah, had to dig into research and figure things out, unfortunately.
Well, yes. So it's, you know, it's great that you had the wherewithal to do that.
And the background, mm-hmm. medical right. background, that you right. knew that a little bit of research goes a long way.
Right.
And yes. and you kind of honed in on the problem, and we're going to get to that realization
yes.
in a little bit.
What is the yeah. average age of onset for individuals?
If there is an average
is
age.
There, oh, yeah, is there yeah. an average?
No, there is kind of an average, and we don't know if it's because this is the population that is the most affected, and it's, okay. say, females in their 20s or okay. so. Or is it their doctors are more aware of the condition, they know mm-hmm. to check for it more. I mean, I was almost 50 when I got sick. My son was 8. Mm-hmm. So we weren't exactly typical, right?
Right. right.
But it was here, probably, oh, gosh, 80% maybe of our patients are female, mm-hmm. although the ages vary fairly widely. That early youth seems to hit them hard, or they get diagnosed at that time. Yes.
Okay. And mm-hmm. why do you think this condition is so often misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed or missed altogether?
Yes, a few reasons. I think in school, as practitioners, we don't really learn much about the autonomic nervous system. We learn the basic anatomy, mm-hmm. but looking for disorders in the autonomic nervous system to us is basically invisible. It's not like you can do a blood test, you know, to figure it out. And then the symptoms are so varied. I remember one doctor saying, Diana, there's no way that you can have a condition that's affecting every system of the body. Mm-hmm. Well, there was.
Yeah.
Right. And what's driving the autonomic dysfunction in most patients, there's another reason for it. And that other reason, whatever that is also causing symptoms. So they're extraordinarily complex cases. Doctors aren't really trained in this area. And even if they recognize the dysautonomia or autonomic dysfunction, they don't know what to do with it.
Right.
And then there's not many specialists taking care of it. And then the specialists that are taking care of it are just basically trying to cover up the symptoms.
Exactly.
So it's a horrible position for patients to be in right now.
I don't know yeah. if you've noticed, we're going to move on to back to the questioning, but I don't know if you've mm-hmm. noticed, but I have, since COVID,
oh. yes.
there has been a plethora mm-hmm. of chiropractors mm-hmm. getting uh-huh. into yeah. POTS care.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of yeah. scares the heck out of me.
Okay, well.
Well, because okay, if it's craniocervical instability,
mm-hmm. right.
a chiropractor
okay,
is
okay,
not your go-to.
Okay, okay,
I'm
okay,
just,
okay, okay.
I have a soapbox. I can get on
no,
it.
No soapboxes.
Okay.
No,
I understand. It's interesting, when COVID came, we knew at POTS care COVID could be significant enough of a virus to trigger POTS in those predisposed, and it was. And we, fortunately, we were already ready. We were ready for remote care and just slipped right into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believed that I could stay in Western medicine, get the answers, if I just dug deeply enough. I was a patient. I had patients at home, you know, that could act like lab rats.
Yep.
I wasn't afraid of doing experiments on myself. And I had the advantage, if you want to call it an advantage, of living with this 24/7.
Yes.
Where other researchers would go home at 5:00, you know, not think about it. And it was a constant thought, always trying to figure it out. So even though it was complex, answers did come. And yes, COVID actually kind of helps explain some of the underlying problems, mm-hmm. because when COVID hit, they started to recognize that the inflammatory response to COVID in some patients was a big problem. And then if you think bigger, that there are other things that can trigger an abnormal inflammatory response in some patients, it doesn't have to be COVID, you get kind of a better picture of what we've been dealing with at POTS care for the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's huge amounts of inflammation.
Yeah. So the million-dollar question is,
yes.
what about intracranial pressure and the vagus
yes.
nerve
yes.
have in common? And how do those two interact or support each other or negate each other to end yeah. up with POTS?
And this was just layers at a time. So as I figured out a layer, it was usually 2-3 years before I could get to the next layer. And this is in the Driscoll Theory. I'm happy to give that book to anybody who wants or needs it. But the first thing I figured out was there's a propensity to develop high intracranial pressure. And Jean, I will say we have never seen a patient at POTS Care who actually fainted or had a history of fainting who did not also have high intracranial pressure. Mm-hmm. And the body is always producing cerebrospinal fluid and always mm-hmm. draining. But when that gets out of whack, and it's usually an inflammatory response, the pressure on the brain, down the spinal cord, and interestingly, behind the eyes, mm-hmm. goes up. That squeezes some of the blood flow out of the brain, which is why, Jean, some people faint. Mm-hmm. Can't think as well. And then it puts pressure on the pituitary. It messes with hormones, puts pressure at the base of the skull. We get kind of tight neck syndrome. And that puts some pressure on the brainstem. And that's your autonomic nervous system. So relieving that pressure is hugely important. And we can do that fairly quickly with medicine, basically. But the commonality with vagus nerve problems, the next thing I figured out, is the propensity for chronic inflammation. And as practitioners, we're very bad about recognizing chronic inflammation that doesn't show up in the traditional blood tests like CRP and SED mm-hmm. rate. Mm-hmm. Those are generally fine. Research, though, is far ahead of practitioners. In research, we've been in inflammatory cytokines and chemokines for many years. So a lot of chronic inflammatory patients get missed, but that inflammation is interfering with the chemical messenger used by the vagus nerve. But it's a bigger problem than the vagus nerve. When I was suspecting vagus nerve problems because digestion would shut down, my gallbladder didn't work, et cetera, my heart's racing, I thought, could this be the neurotransmitter that's affected or the nerve, and how would I figure it out? We don't have blood tests for that neurotransmitter. But I sent out symptom checklists of the symptoms of anticholinergic syndrome. Basically, when you've ingested a drug or poison that breaks down this chemical messenger, there's symptoms that present. And doctors are trained to recognize those because there isn't a blood test. If someone has that sort of syndrome or poisoning and comes to the ER, they're supposed to recognize the presentation. Mm-hmm. And indeed, in POTS patients, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, and interestingly, PTSD, I sent those out to them too. They showed that pattern of anticholinergic syndrome. And being able to replace the neurotransmitter got the vagus nerve working again, but importantly, across the blood-brain barrier to support cognition, made the pupils a little bit smaller. We mm-hmm. tend to get very light sensitive, and tear production went up. So it's a bigger problem than vagus nerve, but I was able to figure that out, praise God. So the commonality there is the inflammation and the effects of it.
Okay, well, I got your book years ago, so I kind of had a heads up on it already.
It's a tough read. I've been asked to put out like a layman's version, you know. Okay. But back then, this was over 10 years ago, no one was considering intracranial pressure, mm-hmm. vagus nerve. No one even knew what a vagus nerve was 15 years ago. Chronic inflammation was new. I had something to prove. Mm-hmm. So I was really laying it out in great scientific detail. Now I think it's more understood. We've been waving this flag, you know, of missing this for a long time. And I think it around the world, word went out, patients were responding, that's great. And then COVID came along that actually helped explain some of that. But yes, I probably should release more about the Driscoll theory. It really isn't a theory anymore. It's been proven many times over.
Right,
yeah.
Right, right.
Or the children's book version.
Yes, yes, for sure.
That's right. I tried to create a layman's version because my sister said, I don't understand it. And so I rewrote it and I gave it to her and I said, okay, is that better? And she goes, I still don't know what you're saying. I think maybe, you know, yeah, children's
You might have to insert your book directly into ChatGPT and say, right. Break it down.
Yes.
It's a great idea. Absolutely.
Well, and yeah. Having, you know, been on the other side of things where I, you know, I'm experiencing it, but I don't know how to explain it, like trying to explain to family members, because they're all like, sit down, sit down. I'm like, you don't understand. If I sit down and then I get up, I'm going to fall over. So I either maintain, you know, stay standing, or I'm going to be seated and then I can't go anywhere. So like, and in like the family parties where, you know, they're all mobile and they're going inside and outside, it's like, I can't. It's just, it's very hard to explain how everything is affected and why I keep falling over. And, but when you said about the pupil dilation, I chuckled to myself because I thought, I remember, so before my pressure, my cranial pressure was improved through two surgical procedures, I would go to the eye doctor and they didn't have to dilate my pupils. To take photographs of my optic nerves because my pupils were so large.
That is classic among your patients.
And so I did think it was like a milestone. The last time I went to the eye doctor, they're like, we're going to have to dilate your pupils. And I was kind of like, yes, you have no idea what a win this is.
I totally get it. Well, the autonomic nervous system is the only thing that controls pupil size as long as the light is the same. So unless you're on a drug or medication that changes your pupil size, the sympathetic, the fight or flight system, makes the pupils bigger. And the parasympathetic, that rest and digest system of the body that was broken in me, makes the pupils bigger. So across the board, our patients have big pupils. We correct that. We normalize that, which can be a sign that it's normalizing in areas they can't see. So it's one objective marker, which is like you'd experience, Jean. It's great to be able to see something objective, you know, improve.
And to say, oh, this is better.
Wonderful.
And you know, I've got to ask you, because of your first love of diseases of the eyes. Is that why now I have to wear prisms? Because when I'm driving, I swear to God, there are double or triple of the car that's in front of me. I mean, and then if I close one eye, I'll say, oh, there it is. Yeah. If I close the other eye, well, it jumps because it's not my dominant eye. But then if I have both eyes open, I've got three or four cars in front of me. And then I have to guess, well, can I get around this one? Well, that one might not be there.
I do not like this. One thing that gets missed all the time, and I went through something, it was a little more subtle than your experience, but being an eye doctor, I was able to figure it out, where I looked down at my car radio and it looked like it was moving away from me. My depth perception was off, and I did just a test right in the car and figured out that one of the muscles of the eye, the lateral rectus, wasn't working right. And the eyes weren't able to track together, which is one reason we need prism. You should not have an adult onset of double vision like that unless something is affecting the muscle. The first thing that we should consider is the neurology. And in my mind, when I was going through that, I thought, okay, what are the causes of a lateral rectus paresis? Number one is high intracranial pressure. And I remember thinking, well, that's not it. I don't have that, you know. What are the other reasons? And none of the other reasons made any sense. I wasn't having a stroke, you know. And I kept going back to high intracranial pressure. And I thought, is that even possible? Yes, it was. So adult set strabismus, as you're experiencing, should be evaluated for high intracranial pressure, and that's a very common consequence.
Well, I think that's going to lead us into my next question. How does your approach differ from conventional medicine, Western medicine?
It's completely different. Completely different. We do nothing to try to cover up symptoms. In fact, if anything, we need to know what the symptoms are to guide us, because we can't always measure things, right? So what we look for is there some underlying inflammatory process driving it? Is it affecting the cardiovascular system, which often it is? What can we do about that? Is the intracranial pressure affected? And this inflammation, is it affecting the vagus nerve and the brain and the tear production and pupils? So there's certainly medicine to bring down pressure. That's fairly straightforward. But figuring out this, quote, vagus nerve problem was quite the journey. My doctors wanted me to remove my gallbladder, and that just didn't make any sense to me, because it wasn't infected, it wasn't inflamed, you know, it wasn't filled with gallstones. And I told them it sounded neurological. And I wanted to think about it. And then I did get to the point, unfortunately, where I had complete gastroparesis. I could not move my bowels. And the doctors tried everything. They even sent me to a surgeon to see if maybe he could open the valve between the large and small intestines. But no one could help. So I was at home just thinking, well, I'm on my own here. And what I did was all of the research to that date was to look for an autoimmune condition that affected the receptors of the parasympathetic nervous system. And I thought, if this is a vagus nerve problem, there is more than one set of receptors. If my vagus nerve is damaged, there are receptors on what's called the postganglionic vagus nerve, a tiny, tiny part of the vagus nerve that's almost a part of the organ itself. And I didn't have any evidence of autoimmunity. So I thought, I wonder if those receptors still work. And I tested them with a nicotine patch. Nicotine is a substitute for that neurotransmitter at the side of the vagus nerve. Worked great. I had a bowel movement within an hour or so. The valve opened and I used it again the next day and the next day. But nicotine is very inflammatory. It starts to work against you. But it told me I had receptors, and other patients responded the same. We have receptors that are viable. This is not an autoimmune condition shutting these receptors down. No one thought to test the receptors, which kind of blows my mind. So we had active receptors. Is there a way I could put together a supplement blend? I wanted something over the counter. I didn't want us to have to make a new drug, you know, although that's really where the money is in research. And I sat down with my genetics knowledge. I wanted to cover for any genetic problems making that neurotransmitter. My ancient organic chemistry knowledge is decades old, but I was always a geek and I loved chemistry. And sat down to try to figure out how to increase the level of this neurotransmitter, keep it at the site of the receptor, and trigger the nerve, and came up with what's now called Parasym Plus. I wanted to make sure it crossed the blood-brain barrier to support cognition, which it did, and allowed me to stay awake, which was amazing. And importantly, perhaps for you, Jean, the pupils got smaller, tear production went up, and we knew we were hitting all of the receptors correctly, and that was important. The other thing that affects patients, I think warrants a mention, is this inflammation doesn't just continue to damage the blood vessels, organs, which is why my organs started to suffer, but it changes our brain chemistry and it makes us more anxiety prone. But sometimes it exhibits like anxiety and sometimes it exhibits more like this OCD, overachievement, attention to detail. We like things a certain way. We're very high achievers. We're at the top percent of everything we do, you know, until we get sick. And it's across the board with our inflammatory POTS patients. But the change in brain chemistry can go from a positive thing that society rewards, you know, to a negative thing. And we've seen patients even afraid to leave their home. I couldn't make a phone call. You know, that was too stressful. I couldn't handle a stressful thought when I was really sick. So that oxidation is something we can also hit. Fortunately, over the counter, I put out NACMAX to correct that. So we control the oxidation long enough. Not only does the brain chemistry subside, but you have a fighting chance to stop the inflammation because oxidation makes inflammation worse. Okay. Yeah, it's quite the cycle that patients get caught in.
Well, that's quite different than a conventional treatment, which focuses on managing symptoms, which means you're going to six different doctors to get six different medicines to treat six different organs, which initially it starts with the neurotransmitter.
Right, but it can help because like they'll control your heart rate, but that will have side effects.
Yep.
And you're going to be taking the traditional method of literally taking salt supplements, which is kind of wild because everybody else is like, cut back on salt. And here you're, you know, the conventional wisdom is like, okay, push the salt. And then also push the fluids. So you get very, I mean, at least for me, I got very puffy, which isn't the greatest thing. And then compression garments. So you're wearing compressions, you know, leggings, maybe compression arm covers, and really trying to do things kind of like a fighter pilot would do. And that's kind of how I was looking at things. Like, I'm trying to keep my blood by, like, push my blood up and in and up towards my brain, and you're fighting gravity the whole time. And it's not really a fight you're going to win.
That's so true. You know, the problem with the traditional treatment, one is not only does it not address what the underlying problem is, but high salt and florinef is also oftentimes given to improve the blood volume. Both increase intracranial pressure.
Oh, so you're and fighting against,
Exactly. And then we see this chronic inflammation changing the cardiovascular system. Salt is one of the chronic salt. High salt is one of the worst things you can do for the vascular endothelium, that inner lining. So it's like this traditional treatment is oftentimes keeping patients sick or making them sicker. If we can pull away from just trying to cover up the symptoms, this isn't a case of just mild dehydration, you know, a Gatorade isn't going to cure you, you know, instead figuring out why that cardiovascular system went down, avoid things that make it worse, the patient has a fighting chance to recover.
Got it.
So the treatments that you offer at your service helps to
balance the neurotransmitters.
Without excess medications that will do damage to the organs over time, right?
That's exactly right. And I remember as a patient thinking, if I put anything in my mouth, it's going to have to be something to help the underlying problem that I could allow my body to heal, not anything to cover up symptoms, and certainly not anything that could possibly cause more damage.
That makes sense. And many of our listeners who are living with POTS are also living with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. What is the connection between the two?
I am so excited to release this. Very basically, and there's a whole chapter in the book on the Driscoll theory about what went wrong with Ehlers-Danlos. Ehlers-Danlos, very briefly, is considered to be like a joint hypermobility, perhaps abnormal connective tissue or collagen, making people stretchy. And I didn't think I was hypermobile when I went through this, but the geneticists at Mayo Clinic said, no, we think we are. We need to do some testing. And indeed I was. They did a skin biopsy and it showed that abnormal collagen. And they said, okay, we're going to call this Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. It's a genetic disorder of connective tissue. I said, oh, well, what genes are involved? They said, well, we don't know that. Okay. How do we know this is a genetic disorder of collagen or connective tissue unless we can point to the genes? Do we know it isn't a genetic disorder of inflammation that could weaken the connective tissue and it would show up like on a biopsy? And they said, yeah, we don't know that. I said, or could it be both? Could it be a gene that controls not only connective tissue, but also the inflammation that affects connective tissue? And that would be a horrible combination. They said, yeah, we don't know that. So I think we shouldn't use the term Ehlers-Danlos until we can point to the gene, and then probably will change the labels where it's more specific as to what exactly is happening. But what's really important for patients to know is if they're diagnosed with hypermobility or Ehlers-Danlos, oftentimes the doctors will say, this is a genetic condition, so there's nothing that can be done. And that's what they do.
So that's why they fall back to that. Because then they have a get out of jail free card.
Well, it completely ignores any treatable aspect of it, and it gives zero hope to the patients. So know that I am still hypermobile. My children are still hypermobile. We do not have POTS. We are not sick, and we don't plan to be sick. So, yeah, it's an unfortunate situation, I think.
Okay. And what has advocacy about, you know, POTS meant to you? And how has it shaped your life?
This is such a personal journey for me now. I was disabled over 10 years, and my journey to wellness was probably over 15 years. Watching my kids suffer, I mean, my son, when he was 9 years old, we had no answers at that time. He came to me and he said, "Mom, you need to know I can't keep doing this. I can't go on one more day." Oh, heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. You know, the suffering that patients go through is so significant. And once you've been through that journey, the empathy that I feel for patients and wanting to advocate for them, this is real, this is medical, this should not be happening, you know, it's horrible. It never stops. As soon as I start talking to a patient, it takes me right back to where we were in that journey. Yeah. And I look back on that and I do think that shouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness it had a good ending, right? There's so many people suffering needlessly, and I'm on a mission to change that. We need to change the labels. We need to base it on the genetics and have objective markers that will validate patients for what they're going through and will point toward where the treatment needs to be. Yeah.
Excellent. Great.
It's my life. It's my life.
And we appreciate all that effort because, yes, it, you know, especially after post-COVID, you know, the sheer number of individuals who are living with all of these complications, really, and it,
yeah,
the numbers
have gone off
so
the charts.
Yeah,
that is so true, and it's why I'm so grateful for opportunities like this to share my story. I'm just one voice, mm-hmm. and I'd like to reach as many people as I can, mm-hmm. so that they're suffering the way I suffered and right. my kids suffered. So thank you for that.
Oh yeah,
that means so.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have a lot of listeners that have POTS, mm-hmm. and you know, they also struggled for 10 or 15 years
to get a diagnosis. And what advice do you have for someone
right.
who's just been diagnosed or is searching for answers?
Yes, I think I coined the term inflammatory POTS years ago. This was before COVID even. And I remember specialists who just kind of poo-pooed it. Oh, there's no such thing. I was like, oh, no, you wait. You'll see it. You know, and COVID kind of helped with that. But I have a page on the website at POTSCare.com called Inflammatory POTS. It's a good place to start. I'm happy to share the Driscoll theory with anyone. I also have a Patreon account where I'm putting as much information as I can, just packing it full. And then I meet with patients every week or two, answer their questions. We talk about things to try to help as many people as possible. Those are probably decent starts. The supplements that I talked about, I've got 5 patents now on those. Those are at vagusnervesupport.com. And you don't have to know what type of inflammation you're dealing with to put that in place. And it's over at the counter for a reason, and that mm-hmm. can be helpful.
Okay, so we'll have links for that
yes.
in the show notes.
Yeah, we put a page together
just for
on
episode,
our website
yeah.
for each of our guests, and then we load it with as many links as possible that will help other people as they move forward in their journeys. So we definitely
Wonderful.
Appreciate that.
Oh, I'm so happy to have that shared. Thank you. Thank
well,
you.
And thank you so much, Dr. Driscoll. We really appreciate you taking the time out of, like I said, we know you are very busy, so we really appreciate it. And your insights have been incredibly helpful and validating as well. And would you like to share any other, like, do you have social media as well?
Oh, I think I'm everywhere right okay. now. So there's YouTube, there's PodsCare, there's me personally. LinkedIn probably isn't like the very best, but we're on Facebook, Instagram. Okay. And I think, too, in terms of what I learned for the autonomic nervous system and chronic inflammation also affects so many other people. Mm-hmm. If you take POTS and kind of turn it down and look more at like fatigue or sluggish digestion, brain fog, you're looking at older age illnesses, for mm-hmm. example.
Okay.
We could do a better job of being proactive for that inflammation, keep that nervous system working, the blood vessels healthy, and we can all age better without, we don't have to have POTS to benefit from some of that. So I do think bigger, too, on how to help more people.
That's fantastic.
Excellent, excellent.
Yeah.
Well,
thank
we
you.
Definitely appreciate your time here today, and For our audience, thank you for listening. And if you have any questions or comments related to today's show, you can contact us at info@podcastdx.com. And we're also on, we have a website. We're on Facebook, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast.
And as always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you heard on this podcast.
Till next week.